from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Thuy Vu, in for Mina Kim. When reporter Rob Schmitz began writing about modern China, he was overwhelmed by the scope of his project. He decided to focus on a microcosm of the Chinese experience, his own street in Shanghai. Schmitz interviewed the street's residents, including survivors of labor camps, ambitious entrepreneurs, victims of investment scams, migrant workers, and expats. He'll join us to discuss his new book, all about what one street can reveal about the cultural and political changes sweeping Chinese society. That's all coming up on Forum after the news. From KQED Public Radio, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Thuy Vu, in today for Mina Kim. Rob Schmitz is China correspondent for the Marketplace radio program on American Public Media. He's been living in Shanghai since 2010 and has been observing and chronicling the lives of those who live in his neighborhood. It began as a special series for Marketplace, where for a year he would do a single story every month about a person who lived or worked on a single street. Now he's turned those accounts into a book titled Street of Eternal Happiness, Big City Dreams Along a Shanghai Road. Rob Schmitz joins me now in the studio. Good morning. Nice to have you here.
Good morning. It's great to be here, Thuy.
And a homecoming for you as well. You used to work at KQED.
I used to work here. This was my job for about 4 years. I was in Los Angeles working for the California Report, so it's just fantastic to be back here.
Well, it's wonderful to have you with us. You know, I was reading your book and it made me curious about why you chose the old French concession part of Shanghai to live in. It's where you and your family now live. Why is it called the French concession and why that particular street?
I can answer why first. It's a very easy answer to that because I live on that street. And it was a very manageable street for me to cover as a correspondent who was sort of being pulled in all sorts of different directions. I'm the only correspondent for Marketplace. So I was extremely busy and it was something that was very manageable for me. Now, the neighborhood that I live in and the neighborhood that this book is about is the former French concession. And the French originally built this neighborhood in the mid-19th century after the Opium Wars, and the foreign powers were dividing up several Chinese cities, Shanghai being one of the main ones. The French took a part of Shanghai that was around southwest of the city wall, and these were all rice paddies before, and they basically built a neighborhood that resembles a Parisian neighborhood in many respects, complete with trees that were being used in urban planning throughout the world in the 19th century. The London plane tree, which is one of these super urban trees that can withstand a lot of pollution, which is good for China, of course, today. But we're a really appropriate tree because basically they planted them around every 15 feet or so along all of the avenues. And then the way that they prune them, the trees start to grow into each other. And so when you look down the streets in this neighborhood in Shanghai, it's like looking down green tunnels. Mm. And it really creates an interesting effect, and it's very distinctive in China.
And you interviewed a number of people on that street, survivors of labor camps, entrepreneurs, victims of investment scams, expats. What do their lives tell you about Shanghai and about China?
Well, right now, I think I wanted to capture a place and a time in China that that I haven't seen before. You know, so I've lived in China off and on for about 20 years. I first came in the 90s as a Peace Corps volunteer, and I lived in rural China in Sichuan province. And I've seen myself, obviously, a lot of change in that time. And so around the time that I came to China, I think that China really had one goal, and not only the government, but the people also. And that goal was to improve their economic status. It was on track to become, you know, a member of the WTO. People were moving to the cities, working in factories, trying to make more money to make their lives better and to make their lives better for their families. Now, a lot of those goals, now that we are in the 21st century, a lot of those goals, especially for folks in Shanghai, have been achieved. And the dreams are starting to sort of spread out like wildfire. And now many Chinese folks are dreaming about many other things, you know, beyond materialism. We're looking at spirituality, looking for a value system that works for people. We're looking at equality, justice. You know, there are dreams that are spreading out like crazy. And I wanted to capture this time, this era of big dreams in China. You know, you also have the state-sponsored Chinese dream that comes from the top. It comes from Xi Jinping. It's a guiding principle that he's laid out a few years ago when he took power. And I think it's not a coincidence that the Chinese dream was born at this time, because I think that the state itself is a little worried about how far these individual dreams will go, and they want to corral these dreams into one dream for the country. So there's a lot of dreaming going on right now, and I wanted to capture that.
And speaking of big dreams and spirituality, I think there's one particular character in your book that really highlights that very well. In fact, you start your book with him. You have five main characters. The first person you profile is Chen Kai. He sells sandwiches and accordions.
A combination that you can only find in Shanghai.
Yes, but you've also seen his evolution over the past
Absolutely.
6 years. Tell us about him.
So Chen Kai is in his early 30s. He was born in the 1980s. He's still pretty young. He's from a pretty heavy industrial area of China. He's not from Shanghai. He made it to Shanghai with a dream to basically be self-sufficient. He had a job as a manager at a state-owned factory assembling accordions, and he has his degree in he's a musician. He plays the accordion. He really disliked that job because he wasn't learning anything. And this is pretty typical at state-owned enterprises in China, and this is one of the reasons why they're starting to reform that sector. But he noticed this right away, that he wasn't going to learn anything there, and he was really hungry to learn. And so he quits. He moves to Shanghai with this big dream of trying to make it in the big city. He pairs up with an Italian engineer who is from a very large accordion company in Italy. And this gentleman teaches CK, his name is CK, Chen Kai, to assemble and disassemble an accordion, basically, from scratch. Mm-hmm. And he learns this. He then starts to manage an assembly line of workers and trains them. And then becomes quite wealthy, actually, doing a lot of this. He sells these accordions, they're called pulverinis, to middle-class Chinese. And on the side now, he's saved enough money to be able to start his own sandwich shop, which does not do very well because he's not really, I think he's more of an engineer than a businessman. Mm-hmm. And he's a big dreamer. But his dream really with this sandwich shop is to have a place for people like him, artists and musicians, to gather and to socialize while he's doing deals for his accordions on the phone all day.
And what I admired about his story is that he has achieved his dreams in many ways, but it was a really arduous journey. I mean, there was a point when he tried to commit suicide.
Yeah.
And his life is very much about the struggles that are sort of, I think, emblematic of China, right? His constant, the constant tension and the push and pull of trying to live under a state system, trying to live under expectations, not only from the regime, but also from your
His
family.
Parents. Yeah.
And how to try to make peace with that, but also have a slice of your own life.
Absolutely. You know, CK had, as you mentioned, he tried to kill himself when he was 11 years old. He had a very difficult childhood. He had a very tough father who abused his mother. They divorced. He's the only child. The only other person in the household was his grandmother. You know, one night when he was 11 years old, you know, he slept like many Chinese kids. He slept in the same room as his grandmother. He actually slept beside her, and he tried to slit his wrists. He actually did slit his wrists, but it didn't work while he lay beside her. And it was thank God it was an unsuccessful attempt. And after that, I think he withdrew really and started to study really hard and worked hard. But that pressure from his parents and his father had put a lot of pressure on him to excel and to do well and to actually join a state-owned company. But all of the characters in my book, CK included, they're all, I think, I make this reference into the book that that living in China right now and dealing with not only the political system but also the cultural system in China, the expectations from your family, is sort of like swimming in waters with a riptide, with a rip current. The current will pull you out if you let it. If you try to fight against it, you're not going to do well. You'll get exhausted and you might drown. The trick is to obviously swim at a diagonal, to kind of let the current take you a little but kind of go in your own path. And in many ways, the characters like CK in this book that succeed are the ones who are able to do that. They're able to carve their own individual path, but also ceding that power to the system in many ways. And that's the political system, I would say. It's also the societal system in China, which I think are very strong elements of living there. And it's just ever present in your life.
And is another way they cope by just molding how they view the government, both on the grand scale and on the local scale. What struck me in your book is that many blame their predicaments on local officials, but they continue to embrace China's central government as good.
That is the kind of running belief in my travels in China. Whenever I am reporting on problems, especially in rural China, you always hear the same thing. Local government bad, central government good. It's the exact opposite of, in some ways, of how Americans see their own government.
Do they honestly believe that, or do you think they're telling you that because you're a Western reporter? Is it really that black and white?
No, I honestly think they believe that. I've been around long enough to know that, and I do think that they believe that. And it's an interesting belief because... And it's in many ways that benefits the central party greatly. And it's in some ways a good cop, bad cop system, you know, where the bad cops are always the local government officials who are, you know, it's the narrative goes, are always corrupt, are stealing property from everyone. And of course, in my book, I talk about this. There's a big land seizure section of this story. But the reality obviously is not so black and white. Local government officials get a terrible reputation in China, but they're under an incredible pressure to not only create GDP growth, but to do all sorts of things that implement central government campaigns. They also need to direct their revenue towards the central government. They take 70% of the taxes that they collect go straight to the central government. And so that prompts them to do things like steal land from the residents. Put their residence somewhere else, and then sell that land to generate revenue and to take a little off the top. But I think it is the system itself that creates this and creates the pressures on the local governments. And I don't think it's as black and white as a lot of folks think it is.
We're discussing life in modern-day China with Rob Schmitz, China correspondent for the Marketplace radio program on American Public Media. He has a new book out titled Street of Eternal Happiness, Big City Dreams Along a Shanghai Road. You mentioned earlier that you came to China in 1996 as a Peace Corps volunteer, and then you came back 14 years later in 2010 as a correspondent for Marketplace. How had the country changed during that time?
It almost seems like a different country now. There are familiar things that you see, but you know, so if you squint your eyes and kind of look, kind of through the squinted eyes, it looks the same, maybe a little, but or it sounds the same, it feels the same, but the change physically is incredible. I lived in a city called Zhejiang in Sichuan province in the 90s for 2 years. I returned there a few years ago for Marketplace to do a story on how things have changed, and the change was unbelievable. Back when I had lived there before, I was myself and my two sitemates, we were the first foreigners to have lived in that place since before the revolution in 49. So our existence there, I'm white, walking around there. Was just crazy. People would follow me. There'd be like this running, like almost like a sportscaster narrative going around me, like saying, "Oh, he's buying the potatoes. Oh, he's paying too much. Oh, now he's buying the eggs." Blah, blah, blah.
Your whole life was on display.
Yeah, I was a celebrity. I was, my whole life was on display for everyone, and folks just followed me everywhere. And now, of course, that's changed. There are more foreigners that go through there, so I'm not a novelty anymore. There are hotels there. There's 5-star hotels. There's a McDonald's. There's a Walmart. And the people that I knew back then, my Chinese colleagues, they're starting to When I came back, you know, these were folks who I worked side by side with in the 90s. They lived in these Stalinist block apartments. They had chickens in the courtyard downstairs. They were very poor. Now they live in, you know, penthouses. They live in these luxury condominiums. They've converted to Christianity, or they're Buddhist. They've gotten divorced. They own a car. They're traveling around China, touring with their families around China. One boy that I knew back in the 90s who I tutored, he was 11 years old, he has now become a famous artist. His paintings sell for around $50,000, $60,000 a painting.
Isn't that amazing?
So yeah, it's just, the change is absolutely...
It's mind-blowing.
It's mind-blowing, yeah.
And in your book... That's Shanghai. Obviously, disparities still remain in China. In your book, you kind of describe the way that Shanghai has risen as it relates to the country's household registration system. And I found that whole explanation very interesting in how it's kind of contributed to this chasm between rich and poor. Can you explain how that registration system works and how it has played itself out over the years?
So in the book, I profile, she's one of my main characters, a woman named Zhao Shiling. And Zhao owns a flower shop on the street. And she comes from a small coal mining village. She works very hard to break away from an abusive relationship. And she takes her eldest son, she has two sons, she takes her eldest son to Shanghai. Her son goes to school in Shanghai. He goes to elementary school. He goes to middle school in Shanghai. He's at the top of his class. He wins a national essay writing competition. He is poised to go to an elite university and do very well, possibly to graduate school abroad, right? He's an incredibly intelligent boy. Because he is not from Shanghai and his household registration, known as hukou in Chinese, does not belong to Shanghai, he must go to high school in where his hukou belongs to, in the coal mining village. So, of course, he goes there. If he wants to go to college, he has to do that, because if he wants to take what's known as a gaokao, the National College Entrance Examination, he needs to return to his hometown. He does that, but the problem is that the National College Entrance Examination is different in every province. In Shanghai, it's one of the easiest. And in Shandong, where he's from, which is a larger province with more people because they have to sift through more kids, it's much more difficult. And so the curriculum at high school was incredibly difficult for him. He ends up dropping out of school, and he returns to Shanghai as a migrant worker just like his mother, and he becomes a hairdresser. And this is someone who should have ended up in an elite university. He should have been contributing more to China's economy. But because of this hukou system, you have around 300 million Chinese, at least, who are an underclass in China. They don't have the same rights as people who are from urban areas. And sociologists in China, Chinese sociologists, compare this to apartheid in South Africa. Now, China always, the central government always promises to change the system, but they've really never meaningfully changed it. And when you ask Chinese, most Chinese from rural areas or, you know, who are migrants to the city, this is 40% of Shanghai, for example, what's the biggest problem facing China today? They're not going to talk about democracy. They're not going to say internet censorship. None of these things that Western media constantly cover, they say hukou. That's always number one, and it's a big problem.
And are they optimistic at all that Chinese President Xi Jinping will change things? He's got an anti-corruption campaign. He's talked about, reforming this system in some way.
There is a lot of talk about reform, and some reforms are being made on a more kind of satellite city level, not on the big city level. So people who live in Shanghai who are not from Shanghai, they're not going to see much change. However, I think there's a lot of pushback from local officials on this. And because local officials, if you were to suddenly say, okay, all migrants can come into the city and their kids can go to school here, local officials worry that they're going to have to deal with an influx of migrants coming into their cities. They're going to have to look for jobs for them. They're going to have to deal with possible crime issues if they're unemployed. So this is a real issue. And that scenario could possibly happen. It's very complicated. I think the Chinese believe you can't just do away with this system suddenly. You have to do it slowly. The thing I'm worried about is that the system definitely needs to be reformed. But right now, as we're in a slower economic growth reality in China, it's harder to reform the system. Because if you start to reform this and more people start coming into the cities and there are fewer jobs, it's going to make a difficult situation for everyone.
Even so, with the way things are right now, do you see the gap growing between urban China and rural China? And it's really a tale of two Chinas.
We're looking at two Chinas right now. The first China is those who have made it. 30 years of constant economic growth have propelled them into, or they've propelled themselves in many ways, into the middle class. They're consumers, they're buying iPads, they're traveling to Thailand, they're traveling to Australia, they're sending their kids abroad. Those folks have made it. Most of them obviously are in the urban areas like Shanghai, Beijing, you know, Guangzhou.
Well, they're investing in real estate in the Bay
Area.
They're
absolutely investing in real estate, and they're our neighbors. And so these are folks who are moving their capital abroad. They're moving their kids abroad. They're going to universities here. Then there's the other China, numbering around 600 million people who still haven't been able to make it in, you know, ride this economic growth. I mean, that's a lot of people. That's two Americas right there. And I do see that gap between the first China and the second China widening. And I think that the party itself and Xi Jinping himself is very worried about this because he knows where the Communist Party's power came from. You know, it came from those, that other China,
sure,
that 600 million, right?
The working class.
The working class, farmers, you know. And he also knows that they have little to lose should they get frustrated enough to start, you know, start calling for change. Because obviously the first China I was talking about, they have a lot to lose. And they're more reluctant to probably protest what the party's policies are. So Xi Jinping's policies actually, if you ever get a close look at some of the campaigns that he's launched, including the anti-corruption campaign, a lot of these campaigns are aimed at making life better for that other China. But I'm not sure if it's too late or not. It possibly could be too late because the economy is slowing down and there are fewer and fewer opportunities for some of these folks.
And are there growing tensions?
Yeah, and if you look at China Labor Bulletin, which is a fantastic organization out of Hong Kong that has a map that you can look at online, you'll see that there has been an incredible uptick in protests throughout China in the last year. And that's no coincidence. The economy is not doing as well as it used to be. People are being laid off. Unemployment is rising, even though the official figures don't really represent that. And there's more friction between workers and their employers.
We'll continue our conversation with Marketplace China correspondent Rob Schmitz after a short break. If you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call at 866-733-6786. Or you can email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Thuy Vu, in today for Mina Kim, and you're listening to KQED Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Thuy Vu, in today for Mina Kim. We're talking about life in modern China, as seen through the lens of individuals who live or work on a single street in Shanghai. Joining us this hour is Rob Schmitz, China correspondent for American Public Media's Marketplace radio program. Rob has been based in Shanghai since 2010 and has gotten to know his neighbors well enough to have them open up and share their stories. His new book is titled Street of Eternal Happiness, Big City Dreams Along a Shanghai Road. And if you would like to join our conversation, I invite you to call us right now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org. And we have a listener who wrote in. Her name is Pam. And she said, Rob, you mentioned two people so far who were deeply impacted by domestic violence.
Yeah.
Can you talk about how prevalent that is and about changing gender roles?
Oh, yeah. This is a huge challenge, I think, in Chinese society going forward. We just saw the first domestic abuse law. Domestic abuse is now officially a crime in China. it is amazing that that happened just now, that that it had not been
long.
A crime for it took this long, for so many years. Domestic abuse is, I think, pretty common in China, especially in rural China. They're, you know, basically every female character in my book, you know, is a victim of it. And I think I talk a little bit about, you know, with Zhao Shiling's story, the flower seller, you know, she really is in a tough position because her husband, you know, is very abusive. And after I wrote the book, and this is going to be a story on Marketplace, I think in the next couple of weeks, her husband came to live with her and not try to live with her in Shanghai. She wouldn't allow him. And it was so I'm doing a story about this, and it's a very interesting story because he does not have the economic power that she does. She now makes enough. She was able to afford two apartments for both of her sons. He contributed nothing.
What a reversal of events.
Absolutely. And so when I interviewed her for this latest story that will soon air, she told me, look, he would never dare to hit me anymore because I have the economic strings right now. I'm holding the strings right now. I basically control all the money in my family. I think that as more and more women have more economic independence in China, this is going to change. And we're already starting to see this change. A lot of migrants that came from the countryside to work in the cities were women. And they've completely reversed a lot of the gender roles in China in their families. And they've also been a big part in stimulating the Chinese economy. They work very hard. And just like Zhao, they were able to provide for their families through a lot of the hard work that they did in the big city.
I want to go to the phones at this point as well and welcome Andrea Kensington to Forum this morning. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, I visit Shanghai a couple times a year, and I usually stay in the old French concession, either, you know, and so I'm really familiar with some of the neighborhoods like Yanqinglu or Shanxinanlu. And while I was there earlier this month, authorities were shutting down, bricking in over a lot of storefronts as part of the anti-corruption campaign. And it wasn't lost on me that a lot of these businesses are being evicted because the properties aren't legal, especially along the Yanqinglu, are migrants, you know, so that the fruit vendor, the person that sells, you know, canned and bottled drinks and razor blades or whatever, a lot of these people are migrants. And so I'm wondering, you know, when these sort of, there could be unintended consequences. I'm wondering what Rob thinks about that, because you have, you know, the sort of hukou reform, migrant shopkeepers in Shanghai, but then the sort of specter of rising unemployment and, you know, what's going to happen.
Yeah, that's actually one of the biggest topics in my neighborhood right now. What's going on Shanxilu there? They've been shutting down an entire street worth of tiny shops, kind of like Zhao's, putting people out of business, calling them illegal. And maybe they were technically illegal, but these types of shops are everywhere in Shanghai. So it was obviously a targeted effort to change the look and the feel, maybe, of this street, as well as to get. You know, it has the perhaps intended or unintended consequence of moving a lot of what are known as YDREN, which are people from the outside, not from Shanghai, spread and they scattered basically to other parts of Shanghai or back home. This type of thing, you know, that was surprising when that happened. But I think in some ways, and I don't know the real reason behind it. I don't know if any of us know, you know, I'm trying to get to it, but I don't know if it's anti-corruption drive or not. But what's happening, you know, and I talk about this in my book, you know, this is really a leftover policy of trying to remake neighborhoods kind of by force. You know, there's a story in my book about Maggie Lane, which is this piece of property behind my home, which has this terrible history where it was a beautiful neighborhood, and the local government decided that it wanted to build something more profitable there. They cleared the neighborhood. Some people didn't want to move, and then the demolition crews set fire to people's homes with them inside, and ended up murdering an elderly couple. And actually, the man was a PLA war veteran from the Korean War. He had fought against the Americans for the Chinese. He was murdered by a demolition crew. And that demolition crew ended up being four of the members ended up going to prison. Now, 10 years before that happened, I discovered that the land that actually my own apartment building is on, that was built maybe 10 years ago, but in the 90s, that same exact demolition crew with the same members burned to death a man for my property.
And what are the chances of that twice?
They were not convicted for that, and they blamed that on the man himself. They said that the man set himself on fire. But I found his widow, and I found his son, who was 10 years old when his father died. His widow, since then, since 1996 when this happened, has petitioned the Chinese government in Beijing to reverse the police report that said that her husband had done this and that he was not murdered. She goes to Zhongnanhai, which is the seat of the central government, most important place for the government in China, along Tiananmen Square. She goes there. She's been there several dozen times. She goes there and throws flyers, unfurls a banner. She's tackled by police. She goes to prison. She gets out of prison. She goes back to Zhongnanhai and does the same thing over again. She's done this many, many times for 20 years. Her son, so when I found her, I interviewed her and I was almost scared to ask her what had happened to her son. He was 10 years old when his father was burned to death. Because this is, my land, my apartment is on this land. I tuck my boys to bed on this land. So for me, I'm thinking, oh, this
is just
awful. It tugs
at your heart.
Absolutely. And so when I asked her, what happened to your son? She kind of paused. She said, well, he's still alive. He's 30. I said, how's he doing? She said, well, he's finishing up his PhD at Cornell.
Wow.
And I said, what? And she said, yeah, he studied very hard and he got to Cornell and he has a PhD in finance and he's now working at a very large bank in Hong Kong trading derivatives.
That is amazing.
There's one narrative in this book about this kid who ended up turning something so horrible in his life into he worked very, very hard, very intelligent boy. And now is, making an incredible sum of money in Hong Kong. And I think that story in and of itself, and I've kind of gone far afield from that question, but that story in and of itself kind of represents the concurrent awfulness of China, as well as the hope and the opportunities that exist and the freedom in many ways that exist in China, because it's all there and it's pretty complicated. But I think it captures it pretty well.
Well, speaking of opportunities, Robert writes, why do affluent Chinese people imagine that they're protected from being the victims of a second cultural revolution? Do they believe that?
I think that China's reluctance to deal with its past could be problematic for its future. And I agree. I think that I don't know if folks really believe that. I don't really think that they're even thinking about that right now, partially because a lot of this history has been hidden and also been kind of tucked away. Culturally, I think the Chinese have a hard time dealing with traumatic events like that. I can never pretend to know what it was like to live through that. I learned a lot from talking to people who did, and it was an intensely awful time. But part of my book is about this, is about dealing with the past, trying to reckon with the past. There's an entire section of my book about a box of letters that I stumbled upon between a man and his wife, and he was sent to prison because he was a capitalist. And it talks about the rest of the family was on the street that I'm profiling. Seven kids. She had to give the wife had to give the youngest child away. And it talks a little bit about that time. They were bullied, of course, during the Cultural Revolution. But I think, now with folks being more affluent and having more money, I think this is something that they don't really think about. They haven't really reckoned with it. But at the same time, I also think that Xi Jinping, even though he's been flirting with a cult of personality, I don't think we're yet on a path towards something like this to be repeated again. But that's not to say that it couldn't.
As a reporter in China, how much freedom do you have to talk to people, to write the things that you do? Do you ever feel like you have to be looking over your shoulder a little bit, maybe censor yourself a little bit, because you were able to get really intimate stories from people. Granted, these are people who live on your street, but still, your reporter's well known. You're a reporter in town.
Yeah, and in some ways, their stories are more subversive than if I were talking to a dissident, because these are normal people who aren't looking for attention. I think my job as a reporter in China is pretty complicated. I have. You know, it's an important role because I unfortunately have power over others in the sense that I can go to a village, talk to people. I don't get in trouble. I have a lot of freedom of movement. I have a lot of freedom of what I can do. And I never censor anything unless the source wants me to censor it. But that's the problem, is that I can leave and there is always a potential that the people that I've spoken to who have trusted me can get in trouble. And that always weighs heavily on me because that's something that I have to always think about and I have to be very careful about. So in situations where I think there might be some problems with local authorities, if I'm talking to a farmer or a worker, we'll talk about anonymity. And that's not it. You know, that's not something that, you know, as we as journalists like to give. You know, it always brings up thorny issues. But it is something that I have to deal with quite often because I think for many folks, depending on how sensitive the story is, there can be real consequences to them talking to me. So I think the problem really lies with the people that I speak with and who trust me and who tell me their stories rather than me.
Yeah, it is a dilemma because I'm from Vietnam and I've been back to Vietnam on reporting trips, communist regime there as well. And I remember at the end of the trip, I went to visit some family members, strictly a family social call, not business related at all. But sure enough, after I left, they sent word to me that the local authorities had visited their home and asked why I was there. What did I talk to them about? So you're right. We have the luxury of freedom of movement. We come in and then we get to leave and file our stories. But the people who stay behind are the ones who have to deal with the aftermath.
That's so, right.
Definitely always something you have to be mindful of when you're reporting in
Absolutely.
A communist country. China recently abandoned its one-child policy, and I wanted to take this opportunity to ask you about that as well. Beginning this year, each couple is allowed to have two children. And this is all a response to the country's aging population. They're worried that there won't be enough young workers to continue pushing through the country's economy and propelling it forward. Is the government's response, though, too little, too late?
I think so. I think a lot of the Chinese that I know who are of childbearing age, they oftentimes don't think that they can actually afford to have a second child, especially in a city like Shanghai where putting a kid through school costs so much money and it's so much effort. You know, I think the planned birth policy, excuse me, the planned birth policy almost worked too well in urban areas. For many folks, they're used to it. And many folks are now in their 30s and 40s. They were only children. They're comfortable with that status. And they don't see a problem with having an only child at this stage. So I think in urban areas, it's the same. Now, I think we should mention that the planned birth policy in China, it affected only part of China. It affected urban China. Rural China, even though this rule may have existed in parts of rural China where at the time that the planned birth policy was sort of at its peak, more people lived in rural areas than urban areas, most if not all, I mean, I would say a lot of rural Chinese totally ignored it and skirted the law. And there were a lot of births that were not registered, and there were a lot of people that were not registered. Most of them were women. Most of them were girls because, you know, in China, of course,
boys are
they
revered.
They will have kids until they have a boy. Mm-hmm. And so I think when you look at official figures of the breakdown, gender breakdown of China, I always think to myself when I see those official figures that I think that there are more women than what are being counted because there's a lot of girls out there that were not registered and they were basically born and then, you know, the parents kept having children until they had a boy and then the boy was officially registered. And, you know, these women have big issues because, you know, they don't have real official hukou, and I think that's also a big issue. But I think you know it's an interesting policy now, this two child policy, I guess. because I think that now the government wants it, but I think a lot of the people don't want it.
Mm. We're talking with Marketplace correspondent, China correspondent Rob Schmitz. He has a new book out about modern day China as reflected on his street in Shanghai. His book is called Street of Eternal Happiness, Big City Dreams Along a Shanghai Road. So I wanted to go back to your point earlier about how this new two-child policy may be a little, you know, too little, too late to address the aging population issue in China. So if it's too little, too late, that begs the question, where does China go from here?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And I think that, you know, the economic planners in Beijing are worried about this because, you know, this is an aging population. You have a lot of folks who are going into their 50s, their 60s, they're about to retire. China's retirement age is very low. Women can retire in their 50s, men at 60, and then they live off a pension. And I don't think that that pension fund is going to be there always. And I think that the state is going to have to take a hard look at possibly raising the age of retirement in China. And that's going to be a big issue, I think, among people in China. And you're going to probably have to look at, you know, looking at the labor force in China. Because, you know, China for many years was the workshop to the world. It had this enormous young labor force in the 90s. They don't have that anymore. And so we're seeing, you know, this race to the bottom where a lot of these large factories are being moved to places like Vietnam. They're moving places to like the Philippines, to Bangladesh. And so you have to look at how this is going to change the overall economy of China. I think we're going to see big changes to China's economy because of this demographics shift.
I wanted to ask you about the presidential election as well, because there are those who think that perhaps President Obama has not been tough enough on China, especially when it comes to perceived bullying by China of Vietnam over contested islands. Is there a sense that – a sense of anticipation or dread or however you want to characterize it about what might come after Mr. Obama leaves office?
I think I'd call it dread. I think the Chinese state, the authorities are looking at the election right now and, like Americans, are probably a little befuddled by what's happening. I don't think they know what to make of Trump. I think that – they at one point they saw him as a more of a curiosity, and now that it looks like, you know, he actually could stand a chance to become the next president, I think they're worried. I think Trump's rhetoric about China has a lot of people worried about what would happen under a Trump presidency. On the other hand, Clinton, I think, is also worrisome for them because, you know, when Hillary Clinton comes to China, a lot of, you know, in the past, she has spoken about human rights and she hasn't been scared about it at all. They've always been uncomfortable with that. And I also think that they're worried that she has a more hawkish approach, I think, to the rest of the world. And I think that they're worried about that as well, because, you know, we've seen in the South China Sea, China sort of taking advantage of, even though the United States has pivoted to Asia, so-called pivot to Asia, the U.S. hasn't really done anything about these new artificial islands that China has constructed in the South China Sea, apart from just saying we don't like that and maybe sailing a ship here and there nearby or flying a plane nearby, but nothing really decisive and nothing actionable really. And I think that China sees that and they will continue to do this until probably something is done. You know, and I think that they're probably trying to do it as fast as they can before the next president comes into power, because I think they're worried about potential action from the next president, whoever that may be.
And China very much wants to be seen as an international market economy type of leader, right? But
sure.
Earlier this month, the European Parliament refused to give it market economy status, basically saying that Beijing is not there. It doesn't have the kind of economy where prices can be determined by supply and demand, like in the U.S. and Europe. It's something Beijing has been wanting for 15 years. Will that ever happen, or it just won't happen under this type of communist system?
I think it's going to take time. I think it will happen. I think China is on the path to that type of status. But I think also that the economic planners in Beijing are, you know, they're part of an historic shift no economy has really done what they're trying to do right now. They don't really have a roadmap. They're basically transforming from a very state-controlled currency regime, as well as a state-controlled market in many ways, to an open free market. And they really want to make this change. But that kind of change for a country as large as China, for an economy as large as China's, is incredibly difficult, especially now that the economy is starting to slow down. Of course, the economy is starting to slow down in part because of these efforts. And I think we can expect a bigger slowdown to come if they're serious about doing this. And I think that they are. I think they're serious. But, you know, I think also that this economic shift and the success of it is important for the rest of the world. It's important for us. We're going to benefit from this as Americans. I think also the EU will benefit from it. If it is not made, if they fail at this, I don't think the rest of the world will benefit at all. And I think that this could stand to really have a large impact, a negative impact on the global economy.
Within China itself, within your street, is there a lot of concern over human rights? There certainly is concern here in the U.S., but how does it play out on your street in Shanghai?
It's funny because human rights, as defined, I think, by the Western media, include things like, you know, access to the internet or freedom of speech, obviously.
Suppression of dissidents.
Absolutely, yeah. But I think that the people on my street, they see human rights in a different light. You know, they're looking at rights like, I want my kid to be able to go to a school in Shanghai. I'm not from Shanghai. Or I wish that the government wouldn't have stolen my house and it would have given me a better deal for it. You know, these are the rights that I think the people on my street are talking about. They're not talking about, oh, I wish I could protest in front of the government building in Shanghai. They're not really thinking about that because I think that they're not at a point yet where that's a big issue for them.
It's a different lens for them.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, we in the West, I think, need to consider this when we see China. You know, I think and we need to learn about this, how they see the world, because their world is very different from ours. They're not, you know, in many ways, many people have made it, but I think a lot of people have not. And, you know, a lot of folks on my street are still sort of, you know, they're living paycheck to paycheck and these paychecks aren't big. And so what they're trying to do is they're focused on making life better for their family. They're not really going beyond that. Some of them are, but they're not really at a stage yet where they feel like they need to put their neck out and start protesting about this right or that right. In my opinion, a lot of the folks on my street, they actually have a lot of freedom. You know, CK becomes a devout Buddhist. He worships under a master who's really an unlicensed kind of, it's an unlicensed temple. It's kind of off the books. But he has complete freedom to worship, and you know they're he's learning a lot about Tibetan Buddhism. You know, he's not Tibetan, so you know
CK is quite a character. He sells sandwiches. He sells accordions. He's now a devout Buddhist.
He started out as kind of this rakish individual, and now he's become a devout Buddhist. I mean, the change that these characters go through over the course of the book is absolutely amazing, and I think it really, in some ways, it kind of represents the change that you know, this amazing economy has gone through in the last 20 years.
We also have an email here from Rick. He writes, so I was in Hong Kong in fall of 2014 during their gay pride events and Occupy Hong Kong. I was so impressed with the student leaders and the young people there. What do you think is the future of Hong Kong?
Oh, wow. I don't see a very bright future for Hong Kong, in the sense that I don't think it's going to maintain its independence that it's had for so many years. It basically is part of China now, and the Chinese government is accelerating its control over the island and Kowloon. And I think we're going to see, you know, the things that we've seen in the past year have been pretty surprising. We've seen, you know, booksellers being basically extradited from Thailand into the mainland, and then, you know, disappeared for months before they're heard from again. And these are very chilling things. And I think for people in Hong Kong, it's absolutely scary. But I don't see, I don't see the momentum shifting in any way. I think if I were a Hong Kong resident, I think I'd be a little worried about this.
And I think we have enough time to take just one more question from Felicia in Menlo Park. Good morning, Felicia.
Oh, good morning. Yes. Well, what a fascinating book. I can't wait to get it. I wondered if he has any insight into here in Silicon Valley, we hear that like 40% of the mansions, the big, you know, the Palo Alto and Atherton mansions that are bought by rich Chinese that as soon as you can't live in China anymore because of the pollution, they're all moving here. Has he heard anything about that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, we know people who have done this, Chinese friends of ours who have a house in San Francisco or have a house in Vancouver. Vancouver is an incredibly popular place for many Chinese. I would say that this is a preview of bigger things to come. This is just the first wave. And I would say that there will be, you know, millions more Chinese, you know, coming to the United States, buying property. Their children will be going to schools here. And I think this is also part of the American dream. This is something that is natural. And I think that in many ways, I think it behooves us to learn as much as we can about the Chinese because they're now our neighbors. And I think that they very much want to be part of America. And I think that's great.
Well, Rob Schmitz, such a delight to talk to you. We were joined this hour by Rob Schmitz, China correspondent for Marketplace, discussing his new book, Street of Eternal Happiness, Big City Dreams Along a Shanghai Road. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks a lot, Tui.
Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, Judy Campbell, Susan Britton, and Mel Baker. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from Amanda Font and Adiza Egan. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman. I'm Tui Vu. In for Mina Kim. Thanks so much for listening. Have a wonderful weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.